Welcome again. Morning to our recovery partners. Yesterday we went as far as page 16. We were supposed to start with 15M. The presenter will take us through, and if there are some of the or some issues that we'd like to seek for clarity on which was done yesterday, at least we had time to go through the piece of legislation after work. We will then ask for clarity from yourself and from members of the police. And also, I need to indicate that I received this document on the implementation plan, but I'm not going to deal with this now. As of October 7th, but I'm not going to deal with this now. We are going to focus on the legislation, and this will deal with when we call the police to come back to take count. Then we can deal with that. At the moment, we are not going to deal with that. And since I managed to get through a copy, and then I discovered that there is a lot of money that's going to be spent on that, so it makes even more serious this piece of legislation, especially if there are such huge amounts that are involved in this. Then the implementation becomes even more serious. Let us then take from yourself, Dr. Ben, on foreign law enforcement letters.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, neighbors. Section 15M deals with foreign law enforcement agencies, and basically this is the situation where South Africa receives a request from another country's foreign law agency, and it's usually dealt with in terms of the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act. And where that act is not applicable, where we have a treaty in place with a particular country. So subsection 1 basically states that the National Commissioner may, on receipt of the DNA profile from a foreign state, compare that profile with those in the NGSA for purposes related to the investigation of missing persons, the investigation of unidentified human remains, the detection of crime, the investigation of offense, or the conduct of the prosecution. And then what may be communicated if the DNA profile is not in the database, the fact that it is not, or if the DNA profile is contained in the database, all the information that the National Commissioner considers appropriate as contained in the database in relation to that profile. Subsection 3, the National Commissioner may, on the request of an investigating officer for the purposes related to the same purposes stated above, communicate the DNA profile contained in the crime scene index to a foreign state. And then lastly, any steps taken under subsection 1 or 2, other than requests relating to missing persons or unidentified human remains that do not relate to the detection of crime, the investigation of offense, that should read an offense, and the conducting of the prosecution must be in accordance with the provisions of that specific act or where applicable in terms of an existing treaty. This is also specifically the situation in Australia, for instance, at the moment, where there is a lot of unidentified human remains, and say somebody who visited there from South Africa, they might find DNA, and there's this kind of tsunami incident to identify. That's where foreign law enforcement agencies use this provision. Then section 15N is compliance with quality management system. This is one of the safeguards built into the bill, and it's based on international practices in this regard. The National Commissioner must develop recommended standards for quality assurance, including standards for testing the proficiency of forensic science laboratories and forensic analysts in conducting analysis of DNA, Members and visitors in the laboratory would have seen that many of these measures are already in place versus writing into legislation, because we've never had a database established by legislation before, but it's not like there's a lacuna in this regard, but the commissioner can answer more questions if there are related to this provision. The standards referred to in subsection 1 must specify criteria for quality assurance and proficiency tests to be applied to the various types of DNA analysis, and include a system for the grading of proficiency testing performance to determine whether a laboratory is performing effectively. Also, this would be the kind of provisions that would have to be proven in court every time some of this evidence is presented in court for the chain of custody, and all of that would come in. So this would have to be proven in court. This is some of the safeguards for the legislation and the whole process. Any privately operated forensic science laboratory that performs any DNA analysis for the purposes of this chapter pursuant to a contract with the state must comply with the quality assurance standards developed in accordance with subsection 1 and any other requirements, such as confidentiality requirements specified by the National Commissioner. Any person who contravenes any confidentiality requirements as specified in subsection 3 or uses or communicates any information obtained as a result of the DNA analysis performed pursuant to the contract with the state in a manner that is not envisaged in such a contract is guilty of an offense and liable to fine or imprisonment. Subsection 3 and 4, I should just clarify, the only instances where this is envisaged that organization, apart from the state laboratory, would be performing a DNA analysis test. It's only in the instances where we take, under section 36B, where we go out now on a massive effort to build up the database. So it's only the non-intimate samples taken from a person that they would translate into a DNA profile. They give all that information over to the divisional commissioner. He loads it onto the database. These other corporations would never have access to the database. They will never be able to do any intelligence or comparative searches. They have no access to any of that. It's done in other countries as well, because the amount of profiles that would have to be developed is just not within the capacity, even if you develop the capacity. So that is part of the budget for the implementation plan, is that one aspect. But it's only related to, they will never look at crime scenes. All of that's done within the state laboratory. Then section 15O deals with the retention, storage, and destruction of samples and DNA profiles. This is the section where we deal with how the actual samples are stored and profiled. Any bodily substance or intimate sample or non-intimate sample used to populate the database may, if scientifically possible, be retained after it has fulfilled the purposes for which it was taken or analyzed. This is where you keep the sample after the DNA profile was loaded onto the database. This is done for quality assurance purposes, to test it in the future. And that's why it's usually picked by a country to do this. The National Commissioner or user or delegate must ensure the safe storage of such retained samples and must develop guidelines for the safe storage and destruction where applicable of retained samples. Some samples just cannot be kept beyond a certain date that have expired, or it just we cannot analyze anymore, then the National Commissioner will destroy it. That's where this reference comes in. An authorized person may at any time destroy any of the stored body substances or intimate samples or non-intimate samples in accordance with the guidelines set out in paragraph B if such samples are no longer suitable or required for the purposes of forensic DNA analysis. A register must, however, be kept by the police officer commanding this division of such stored samples or intimate samples or non-intimate samples which are destroyed by the unit. So anything destroyed must be entered onto this register. And this register must be submitted to the Minister and the National Commissioner on a monthly basis. Subsection 2, subject to paragraph B, no DNA profile loaded onto the NDDSA may be destroyed. This is the this relates not only to the DNA profile, the sequence of numbers that will be entered into the database, and nothing in that subsection prohibits the updating of any DNA profile at a later stage, which may include the substitution of a DNA profile with the updated profile. Then subsection 3, any bodily substance, intimate sample, non-intimate sample, DNA profile, or any information stored on or within or associated with the database may only be used in accordance with section 15L or by any authorized person for purposes related to the legitimate government services. And 15L is, of course, the section that deals with the stipulated search. So you can only use it for this specific reason. And then, again, that subsection that was inserted by the statute of boundaries in certain places where we keep the sample, that they propose that it should be destroyed after 5 years if the person was not selected by court of law. Then we come to section 15P, which deals with offences and penalties. Throughout the bill, we've created offences and penalties with 15 specific subsections, but this is our overarching section dealing with additional offences and penalties. Any person who accesses or uses the database, or who enables any other person to access or use the database for any purpose not related to the specific purposes set out in the bill, any person who intentionally communicates any information that is contained in the database or allows such information to be communicated in circumstances not related to the administration of the database or in contravention of the stipulated search provision or the 15M is the foreign agency's provision is guilty of an offense. Any person who intentionally communicates the information referred to in section 15L1 or 15L2 or to any person or institution other than those listed in 15L2, sorry, that is in the stipulated search, if the stipulated search was done on the database, you can only communicate it to specific persons listed in 15L2, which is the police officer, the judge, or the prosecutor, etc. Then any person who knowingly and without authorization obtains or uses any information stored on the database is guilty of an offense. Any person who, apart from the National Commissioner, is not an authorized person for the purpose of this chapter and who performs any function in terms of this chapter that is reserved to only be performed by an authorized person is guilty of an offense. That means that anybody who is not specifically spelled out in this bill who tries to load samples onto the database or access information is guilty of an offense. And then any person who intentionally or recklessly stores a DNA profile on the database in circumstances not authorized under this chapter is guilty of an offense. We've also had a suggestion to include in here maybe also an offense that the committee could consider of anybody corrupting the database in the sense of the inter-individual technologically, so we can add that in there if the committee agrees. Then section 15Q, of course 15Q is open for any other suggestions of further offenses and penalties to add further safeguards to this legislation. Then section 15Q deals again with national instructions. This time the chapter 5A dealt with national instructions with regard to the prints and the photographs, and this deals with national instructions with regard to the database. 15Q reads as follows: the National Commissioner, in consultation with the Minister, must issue national instructions regarding all matters which are reasonably necessary or expedient to be provided for, and which must be followed by all police officials, in particular those charged with the collection of bodily substances from a crime scene, that's the crime scene expert, or the taking of non-intimate samples, those would be the police officers trained to take the non-intimate samples, or must take such steps as deemed necessary in order to have an intimate sample taken. That would be the medical or the police, in order to have instructions to empower the police to ask a medical practitioner to perform an intimate sample where they need to draw blood, or who are authorized under this chapter to conduct a speculated DNA search in order to achieve the objects of this chapter set under section 15E, including the following: the manner in which to secure a crime scene for the purposes of collecting bodily substances. Some of this is already, of course, set out in the crime scene policy, which we've received from the commissioner, but due to power failure this morning, it could not be copied for members, but this would just be built out on, because the focus would now be in crime scenes, that people must definitely go out and look for DNA, possible exhibits that might contain DNA. In the past, I think the focus was majorly on fingerprints and the like, so it's trying to strengthen the policy in that regard. The manner in which to identify and collect bodily substances from a crime scene, that's exactly that point. The manner in which to take non-intimate samples as provided for Chapter 3, that would be the training or the national instructions, and then the training comes in the next subsection on how to take a blood fingerprint, a buccal swab, and a hair sample. The manner in which this basic conserve and ensure timely transfer of collected samples to the brain science laboratory, as the number is collected in the field, how to get it immediately to the FSL. The manner in which to conduct speculated CNI searches in accordance with section 15L. The speculated search will be done by the software, which is for part of the implementation budget that needs to be acquired, that software used by the FBI, if I'm correct. But then it's the report that's actually finalized by a human person. The manner in which to communicate or request DNA profiles and information in accordance with section 15M, the manner in which the investigative repository for DNA analysis in the FSL should operate, the manner in which the request access information stored on the database, the manner in which the information provided under the chapter may be used for purposes related to, and then again those legitimate purposes set out in the goal, and the manner in which statistics must be kept by the division to, in relation to all information collected, stored, and analyzed in terms of this chapter. Which shall include the recording and maintaining of the statistics of all exhibits collected as a crime scene. And then subsection 2 again requires the development of training courses in relation to all these national instructions. And then subsection 3, National Commissioner must develop and maintain adequate information technology infrastructure and systems to support the efficient analysis of DNA samples and simulate searches against the database. The national instructions contemplated in this section must be tabled in Parliament within 3 months after the commencement of this section. I could add that this subsection it did not appear in the previous, where we talked about body prints, and that was oversight in our part, so we can add it in there. And then regulation. The Minister may make regulations regarding any matter which is required or permitted by this chapter to be prescribed for any administrative or procedural matter necessary or expedient to give effect to the provisions of this chapter. Any regulation made under subsection 1 may prescribe penalty of fine or period of imprisonment for any contravention thereof or failure to comply therewith. Subsection 2 would have to have a cap added to it. It can be up to 12 months. We cannot, in regulation, leave it open-ended as to what penalty can be prescribed, so that should also be addressed. And we've got a different wording proposal on the regulation clause, but we can come to that at another stage maybe. The report to Parliament, the National Commissioner must, within 3 months after the end of each financial year, submit to the Minister a written report on operation of the database for the year, which report shall be tabled in Parliament by the Minister, the usual wording there, and at any time when requested to do so by the Minister or duly authorized parliamentary committee, submit a report on the operations of the database to the Minister or that committee. That's just then the end of the amendment to the FAT Act. Then the next clause deals with the Firearms Patrol Act, and basically the amendments proposed here are consequential to the amendments we've made in the Criminal Procedure Act and the FAT Act. So the definitions we're inserting into the definition clause of the Firearms Control Act are those that are necessary for the consequential amendments we make later on in that bill, and we've already dealt with them yesterday: authorized person, body prints, DNA, DNA analysis, intimate sample, NDSA, non-intimate sample, and speculated search. There is nothing different there. Then clause 8 deals with the amendment then specifically of section 113 of the Firearms Control Act. And this is the provision that's very similar to the one we've inserted now into the CPA, the section 36C, which deals with where police want to investigate the firearms to collect samples, but where they must have reasonable grounds to suspect that a person is committing an offense and reasonable grounds to believe that those prints and samples or the results thereof will be of value in that specific investigation. So it's got that those requirements built into the section. This is an existing section, and all we've done here, we've added in the new terminology, and we've also amended the subsection in the sense that no longer will print and sample and DNA profiles be deleted or removed if a person was not convicted, but it's in the same vein as we tried to do in the Criminal Procedure Act to and build up and strengthen the DNA as well as the fingerprint database. Subsection 1 reads exactly the same thing as subsection 36, and then subsection 2 we've amended where it used to say must immediately destroy them when it's clear that they will not be of value as evidence. We said may cause imprint of non-intimate samples, intimate samples, or the information derived from samples which would be the DNA profile taken under any powers conferred by this section to be subjected to a speculative search. And then subsection 3 provides that intimate samples, of course, may only be taken by a registered medical practitioner. Subsection 4 is the existing subsection in this Firearms Control Act, which deals with firearms. We did not amend anything there. What we did insert were subsections 5, 8, and 6. 5 is the subsection 5A, deals with the retention of such samples and DNA profiles, but only for the specific purposes. Subsection B states that any person that creates an offense if these are used for any purpose other than those clearly stated purposes. And this is exactly the same wording that we dealt with yesterday. And then subsection C just stipulates such prints and body prints must be stored by the specific division and provided for in section 5A. D, that deals with the intimate samples, non-intimate samples, and DNA profiles, and stipulates that these must be stored in section A in chapter 5B of the Stamps Act. And then subsection C is the section instructed by the state or advisor where they propose that if a person was not convicted, that such prints and samples may only be stored, might be stored after 5 years. Then the last two clauses deal with the Explosives Act. Clause 9, again, means the definition in the Explosives Act to bring it in line with the new definitions of the Criminal Procedure Act and the SAP Act. Then clause 10 deals with section 9 of the Explosives Act, for example, for investigative purposes. Again, this is the 2003 Act that was formed by the Safety and Security Committee, which was modeled exactly, basically, on the 2000 Firearms Control Act. And we've made exactly the same amendments to this clause that we've done in the Firearms Control Act. And then it's just a short cycle of commencement. And this states that the Act will come into operation on a date determined by the President by proclamation in the decree.
Thank you very much, Pauline. Where is the last part of the presentation? If there are any questions or questions that you'd like to get from the answers, do so. And Ms. Sutton, I will miss you, and then
Chairperson, just with regards to definition, shouldn't the reasonable grounds be defined as well? I get a little concerned in the area of reasonable grounds. Who's the definition of reasonable?
Is an
clause there that says that it must be tabled in Parliament within 3 months. And I just thought that there you might want to tighten that particular clause up by saying that it is the national instruction contemplated in sub A2J, as opposed to all, because the wording says including, and then the list goes on if you're with me, Dr. Lowe. So obviously there may be other things that national instructions may be issued on, and that can come later, but these ones that we've contemplated in A2J, those ones must happen at the end. Thank you.
Ms.
Sandlake. First of all, I need to apologize to Dr. Lowe. I said yesterday it was a government official in the debate. It was, in fact, the NGO. But my concern was, and I went back to my notes, that the government official did a correction in the debate. So I want to apologize. It was, in fact, not the government official. I just want to ask the question, my question relates to 15N3, the outsourcing of this. Now, if I remember correctly, there's an amount of R1 billion that is budgeted for, is this what is budgeted for? There's an amount of R1 billion that is budgeted for outsourcing. Somewhere along those documents that we received at the laboratory. Is this what it is for? What is perceived, how long is it perceived to continue this process? If it's not that R1 billion, what is the estimated cost for this? Is there, in fact, laboratories in South Africa that can handle this, what you perceive needs to be done? I'm also not quite clear on exactly what it is. Is this what you talk about when you say you want to go to prisons and convict the prisoners, etc., and get their DNA on it? Is that about what you're speaking on? Can we just get some more clarity on the point,
please? I will leave over to them to respond. I never knew that there was something, because it was said you must forget about outsourcing. And that's what I believe in when I'm sitting here. But if outsourcing is still yes, then I have a very serious concern.
Of 6.5 million sets of fingerprints. we did not establish that capacity inside them. Because once we have done that, what will we do with all those people? And if you see a private company does that, and they employ for a period of over 200 people from the company side to do that. And then afterwards, that continues with its normal implementation of to handle with the set, etc. If we think about the prisons now, and I don't know how many people is in prison, if there is 1 million people in prison now, I don't think that must now appoint 2,000 people to go to prison and take all the samples of these people. Because what will we do afterwards with all the people? So we will plan for a phased approach. If we talk outsourcing, it can only be, or the reason why we included it here is to make provision if there is a need for it, to say, when we start off with this process, just to make sure we create as large as possible database as quickly as possible, to bring profiles in, to get the database off the ground. It may be to let some private companies deal with the voluntary interest profiles to us. All they do is they will get the sample and in a specific format, with a specific quality procedure, set a profile to start. Then they have nothing more to do with it. And once it was closed, then it's over and out. There's no way we can continue with it in the long run. There's no need for something like that.
And he said, we're not outsourcing this. We are outsourcing this. Obviously, we're outsourcing this. When we started, we said there is no intention of outsourcing. And now it is here, we are told there will be tenders, there will be this, there will be that. It's obvious that we are outsourcing the whole thing. Then for cruel time, we are outsourcing this thing. And at least all this is
a comment in making on the paranoid. I'm quite comfortable with SEP having my DNA as a normal citizen. But I'm not necessarily comfortable with company XYZ having my DNA.
Ms. Cohen and then Annalise?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, and I don't want to speak for the department, but I do understand the things that, and perhaps it's just a miscommunication as to how things get expressed. But as I understand it, at the moment, the police don't go into prisons and they don't take volunteer samples. That's not part of their job. It's not part of this unit's job. It's got nothing to do with the police. In fact, if you look at, for example, how people do paternity tests, particularly when it comes to things like maintenance and so on, they usually go to these private laboratories to do the DNA analysis. I think what SAPS is saying is that because we require them to do two things more than they are doing at the moment, which is the first one being the volunteer index. So you and I and my whole family can go and say we want our DNA on an index. Now, if we go to the police station and do it, then they won't have the capacity because, as we've heard, they're already struggling with the capacity to send people out to crime scenes. So they don't want to assume that additional burden. What I will need to do is I will need to go to a private lab and I would ask them to do my analysis and then forward it on to this unit where the database is kept. In other words, the labs don't keep the database. It's the police that will keep the database. So that's what they want to outsource, number one. The second thing that they want to, and I say outsource in the sense that it's not currently a function of the SSE, so it's not really outsourcing in that sense. The second thing that they want to do is, and this is my understanding, is that you want to obviously go to prison. And again, this is not something that SAPS does, so you would want to outsource, in inverted commas, because not what they do, to prisons as well. As to, you know, how long that is going to be and how long that will take is, I guess, something that they will determine from. But I do agree, Chair, that, you know, these things ought to have been already costed and so on, because, I mean, this is something that they were aware of. And I think that, if it's not in part of that whole exercise, the cost and so on, that should happen. In any event, I think we're talking about the capacity that, certainly with the prisons, I'm not sure about the volunteer index and how that's going to eventually work out, but certainly with the prisons, it seems to me that this is going to be a short period of time after which SAPS is going to have to build up some capacity, because obviously you can't forever send private people into prisons.
Annalise, and then Ms. Simpson, after that, we break for tea.
I don't want to sound funny, but there's nothing that's mentioned in this section about volunteering. And if we talk about prisons, the reason why staff are not going into prisons is currently to do it because it's not required to do it. I mean, it's simple as that. Secondly, I don't think it's going to be for a short period. If SAPS with each capacity, and that's my question, was not whether they are the bodies. I know they are the bodies, quite frankly, and I do not appreciate the fact that the way the questions are answered. I know they are the bodies, but then it depends if it's done on a daily basis. My question was, are they the bodies with the capacity to handle the numbers we are speaking about here in South Africa? Because what we're talking about, it's going to SAPS answer yesterday that but it's going to back off of 18,000, it will take you between 8 and 9 months to work back that backlog. We talk about civil use of operation and civil use. How many prisoners are we talking
about?
187,000. So now we can take 10 times 8 to 9 months. That's how long it will take to do the capacity in the prison. So whether it's tapped with the team or whether it's a laboratory outside, it's not a short period of time that we are speaking about. We're speaking between 80 to 90 months. I think, Chairperson, we need further clarity on this section specifically. We need to be detailed in terms of what it is that we are talking about here, because the two departments are not saying the same thing either. Secondly, we need to have the cost of this as well. And I still don't have an answer on whether there is a laboratory that will be able, with the requirements that SAP and the National Commissioner and that we want of a high ethics standard in this, in South Africa, existing laboratories that can conduct this. I think that's the bottom line.
Thank you. Madam Chair, two things. First of all, if we're talking voluntary, who's going to pay private institutions, private systems, companies to take these DNA samples, to volunteer? I'm not going to volunteer and pay for it and then not have the right to withdraw it. That's the first thing. Secondly, we're supposed to have, and we're supposed to be working towards a totally integrated justice delivery system. If that is the case, why cannot the correctional officials be taught how to do these samples? Why do they have to bring in private firms at all? I have a very serious problem. I actually feel we're trying to push this bill far too quickly. I think that this bill should be held over until the new term. I don't think we should be trying to push it through the way we're doing. There's too much involved in this thing, and there's far too much investigation still to be done before we can look at partnerable answers.
There's powers in that in me and the chair of this. I can celebrate for the
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I can start out by saying I've only summarized the submissions of substance. We received about 108 submissions. Given them all to Jeremy, you would have given you a pack of the others, about 90 or so resistance support, people saying these were both enforceable. So I obviously didn't refer to those. I've summarized the ones received by the committee specifically, and then also from people who made submissions to the department before the parliamentary process. So we didn't have a chance as the department to incorporate those amendments proposed by the public prior to the rule introduction. So there might be some amendments here, but we would have received the whole package from here. I summarized, of course, some themes in the beginning. It's just a general one theme, and then I went clause by clause, and I would deal with the submissions in that manner. The first general thematic submission that was made that referred to specific sections in the bill, but it's the whole issue around the retention of fingerprints, non-intimate samples, intimate samples, and DNA profiles of persons not convicted by a court of law. This is, of course, the bill as drafted by the department. What we would like to do is we would like to retain everything, to build as a substantial database as possible. Also, which I think I'll start with the specific submissions first on this matter. And I'm going to leave all four in this instance, because they all refer to the same aspect, and then we'll deal with the matter further. Firstly, there's Business Against Crime, who submitted that many cases remain under investigation for periods longer than 5 years. In many instances, criminal cases linked to organized crime that do not get resolved upon the conviction or acquittal of an individual. Therefore, Business Against Crime recommended that such evidence, firstly, be kept indefinitely, or that it be kept until such a person applies to a magistrate for his or her records to be destroyed after a period of 5 years, which would go further than the recommendation by the state law advisors, where they think 5 years and then everybody must go off, because then if you apply to a magistrate, it would afford the prosecution in fact an opportunity to make submissions in favor or against the application in light of the nature of the case, or there might be other cases pending. And then lastly, that such evidence begins for a period of 20 years, for instance. So that's really recommendations they make, that they in basic fact wanted to speak in for longer than 5 years if a person was not found guilty by a court. Then the South African Human Rights Commission submitted that it was an unreasonable limitation on the right to privacy to include the DNA sample, here that samples not profiled, in a database of a person who was never charged, against whom charges were withdrawn or was found not guilty subsequent to a trial. This provision also holds serious consequences, they said, for the principle of the presumption of innocence. The principle that there is a presumption of innocence lies at the foundation of that administration of our criminal law. Then there was the Law Society of South Africa, who said that the effects to the retention storing DNA analysis of persons who are acquitted of charges, this will victimize innocent citizens in the country, they argue. Then there was a member of the public, Mr. Kaiser, who said, the bill does not take cognizance of the marker judgment in the European Court of Human Rights, subsection 36B2A, does not recognize the human rights of innocent or unconvicted individuals, are treated and punished, he said, in the same way as convicted individuals. And then there was the Commission on Gender Equality, who said that they supported the retention of samples for 5 years where no convictions occurred. The department's response in this regard is that as other submissions to the committee were in favor of indefinite retention, tried to explain that this DNA database is only really efficient if we keep a large number of profiles on it. So if you find something on a crime scene, the larger your profile base is, the bigger the chances of getting a hit. So if you're only going to include convicted offenders, we're basically going to fit with the same hit rate as we have currently in South Africa, which is a 0.02%, which really does not impact on the intentions that we are trying to strengthen the crime intelligence capabilities of the police through forensics specifically. And then, of course, also on the privacy issue, what is the DNA profile? It's been explained to the committee as well in submissions, and when the committee went to the laboratory, but a DNA profile is nothing else than a sequence of unique numbers that identify a person. So if we now think about the privacy argument, and we take it back to the fact that your DNA profile is loaded onto the database, there's a crime scene somewhere, and your name, your
will never appear unless you're looking for the crime scene. And what happens then is all the police will have is the name of a suspect. Then the normal investigation kicks in, and they will go to that suspect, retake that sample, reanalyze that from the crime scene, check that it's a match, and then the normal investigation will kick in where the person will have to explain why was my DNA in the crime scene match. So, and to the innocence argument raised by the Human Rights Commission, you will still be presumed innocent until proven guilty in court at the end of the day. There's nothing that says there's a match on the DNA database. Now, all of a sudden, you're not considered, you don't have that right to be considered innocent until proven guilty in court. The whole process will proceed. And then also, if I could just say, and the case law in South Africa on this point already, there was a case of S versus Orion. This is the precedent followed by courts in South Africa where the state applied by way of notice of motion to have blood drawn from an accused to distinguish whether to establish his DNA profile. This accused in this case raised all these rights. He raised that this will infringe his right to dignity, freedom and security, bodily integrity, right to privacy, and right to be presumed innocent, and not to have assist the prosecution in proving his case. The court, however, after considering all the factors, came to the conclusion that it's of the view that the limitation clause in the Constitution permits the limitation of these rights through the medium of Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act. The court goes on saying, put differently, the taking of blood samples for DNA testing for the purposes of criminal investigation is a reasonable and necessary step to ensure that justice is done and is reasonable and necessary in balancing the interests of justice against those of individual dignity. So there is precedent in our court jurisprudence already for the taking of DNA samples in this manner. Then, as to the retention of samples as compared to profiles, we can talk about profiles on one end and then samples. Why do other countries in the world retain samples also? There's a number of reasons. They list them as follows. The checking of the integrity and future utility of the DNA database system, a reanalysis of the upgrading of DNA profiles where technology can improve the discriminating power of the DNA matching process. That's the to make it easier to identify the unique markers, a reanalysis and thus an ability to extract other DNA markers and thus offer benefits in terms of speed, sensitivity, and cost searches on the database, and further analysis in the investigations of alleged miscarriages of justice. So basically, to retain the sample is strengthen the integrity of the whole database system for retesting in the future. And of course, everywhere in the bill, it's built in that the samples, the profiles, may only be used for the specific government purposes, and wherever you go beyond this, it is an offense. So that is dealing with the first issue. I don't know if members have questions on the first state submission dealing with specifically the retention.
To read it more commenting than a question, maybe just to make the point that although there are people and organizations who raise constitutional issues, we mustn't see the fact that we may be taken to court as necessarily a bad thing. Because it's also sometimes useful to have a piece of legislation that goes to the Constitutional Court so that the Constitutional Court can make a pronouncement. And there are opinions that say, there are constitutional issues, but it's just an opinion. The only body that can actually make a final determination is the Constitutional Court. And we can't not proceed with something because we are scared that we might be taken to court. It's sometimes a good thing to be taken to court. My personal view on this is that it is a legitimate government service and that it would be a justifiable limitation of the right to ethics.
Yeah, Chair, for me this is probably one of the most important aspects of this legislation because it goes to the very heart of whether we are going to have an effective system or an ineffective system. As you keep saying, it doesn't help to have this wonderful piece of legislation, it doesn't serve the people of this country. And I think we must always bear in mind,
In fact, one of the very I spent yesterday looking at the submissions that we got from ordinary people, ordinary South Africans who were saying why it is they think that this bill should be passed and so on. And I found it very interesting that somebody says it is more an invasion to your privacy to be murdered or raped than to have to give a DNA sample. And I think we must bear that in mind when people start saying things like, you know, it impairs people's dignity to get a blood sample from your finger. So Chair, I accord with what has been said on this issue. I think we must retain indefinitely, but I also think that over and above just the profile, we must retain the samples as well. Because as any good lawyer will do in a court case, if my client's DNA is found to be a match against somebody the database that is, and my client's DNA was found at the crime scene, the first thing I will do is to say that the database could be incorrect. And the only way the police are going to be able to verify beyond reasonable doubt, because that is the test in a criminal case, is to go back to the sample and maybe even redo it if the court deems that necessary. And if you don't keep the sample, for me, that's a huge problem. So I mean, my view would accord with Ms. Johnson to that effect, but also to just add the issue of the sample retention.
If you want to continue then, or respond to this, and or there are some comments or questions.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I will continue to the comment on clause 1. It was only the Commission for Gender Equality. They recommended changing the heading of Chapter 3 that we've made ascertainment of bodily features of persons. Remember, currently it reads ascertainment of bodily features of accused persons. We've broadened Section 37 or the whole chapter to refer to accused as well as convicted persons. They're saying it's unconstitutional and too broad at the moment. This definition, we do not agree, Chair, with your respect to the Commission. It says that pertaining to body features of persons, but the only persons you can take it from within the context of the chapter are the ones listed. You can never go beyond the purview of that. So it's a technicality, Chair, that we. Which deals with Section 36A, the definitions clause. Here we have firstly the National Prosecuting Authority. They refer to the definition of body print as unnecessarily restrictive. The NPA proposes that body print be extended to include any other part of the body. If we look at the definition of body print in the Chapter 3, Section 36A, currently reads body print means print taken from a person's ear, foot, nose, palm, or toes. The reasoning from the department side on why not to say any other body parts is if you read the context of where you take these prints, it's the police who take it. Now, that's what I tried to explain yesterday when we looked at the definition. If we say any other body part, say, for instance, it's a buttock print that was found on a crime scene, now we want to allow the police to take a buttock print from the person, it's too invasive. That's the intimate sample that can, in any case, be taken under Section 37 as it stands currently by a medical professional. So we're saying if there's other areas of the police or of the EPA specifically want to list like lip prints that they refer to, then we can include that because that's not an invasive procedure, but we cannot say any other body part. So if there's specific recommendations on that issue. Then the second comment also from the NPA, the definition of the database requires technical comment made by them requires the attrition of technical definition inconsistent with the general usage of the intention is not only to create a database but also to retain samples. Therefore the EPA proposes that the reference is intended to be made to retain samples as well as DNA information in the database, that reference to samples retained be inserted. They say our definition, that a database definition is usually a number of records or electronic information, and from reading of the bill, we're also keeping the samples on the database. The department, frankly, just stands this comment, really, because the data, it didn't make sense to us. And if you say the database includes the samples as well, there's no faith in that comment from the NPA as far as we kind of understand what they would like us to do. And to include their, I mean, it's clear that today's debate includes everything. So we think we're covered with the definition and the community agreement on that. Then the NPA was on state with the definition of speculative search. They wanted to, the comma after the word taken, the third line should be removed to before the word taken, and we agree with that. There's no problem. So then it's just that speculative search means the body prints, fingerprints, photographic images, intimate samples, or non-intimate samples, or the information derived from such samples, comma, taken under any power conferred by this chapter, comma. We agree. Then there's comments from the Commission on Gender Equality. They say that fingerprint cannot be seen as a non-intimate sample. Secondly, the fact that a swab is inserted into an orifice such as the vagina or mouth is intrusive and intimate. The legislature should reconsider what is intimate and what are non-intimate samples. The CGE further believes that the terms intimate and non-intimate are unable to reflect the technical nature of evidentiary material contemplated in this law and should be replaced with physiological samples instead of intimate and physical instead of non-intimate. In this regard, in most jurisdictions, even all that run a DNA database for criminal investigation purposes, they define it as intimate or non-intimate samples. And I think it's going to be more confusing to say physical or physiological samples. And a swab can only be taken in terms of the legislation from the mouth. That's clearly stated in the bill. And I don't know if there's any other comments from the committee on that submission. Then the second point made by the CGE is to speculative search. The nature of speculative search is reasonable and justifiable, but the term itself undermines the intention of the legislature by introducing a sense of conjecture and inaccuracy. The CGE suggests investigative search or evidentiary for related search. The term speculative search is the terminology in reference to searches run against the DNA database in other jurisdictions. That's why we use that term. There's no comment from the continuing chair. So then clause 2, section 36B. There were a lot of, most of the submissions were made on this particular clause. This is the one where it's now compulsory to take fingerprints and non-intimate samples. Firstly, the NPA, so it says section 36B1A Roman 4. Yesterday when I went through the clause, I've already pointed out to the committee that that was a spelling mistake, so we agree we will change that. It's not supposed to refer to samples, but it should refer to fingerprints. We agree. Then section 36B6A, the NPA proposes that in keeping with wording in the test provision, non-intimate samples should only be retained where applicable and scientifically possible. We can, the department has no problem inserting those words there because it would just, we just thought we'd use it only in the SAP Act because that's where they actually store it, but we should insert it there and look at the committee and say otherwise that there's no problem inserting it there because some samples, once you've analyzed it, you can't use it again, it's already gone. So that's why we say scientifically possible in the other provisions as well. So if we do this, then it would also apply to section 36C3A, 36A, 113.5A of the Firearms Control, as well as section 595A of the Explosives Act. We'll just insert those words there. Then section 36B sub 7, they propose replacing the word crime with offence, and once again we agree because if we refer to offence later on, then there's nothing certain on that. Then Professor Sir Blanche, who is of course a specialist in sentencing, he gave us a submission on section 36B 1 sub B Roman 4. The language used in this section is unclear. Prima facie, it appears as if all sentences are included. In other words, that a sample should be taken whenever there is a conviction followed by a sentence. But why then is a distinction drawn between imprisonment and non-custodial sentences? This is the section, Chair, that the Department would like to amend, actually, or propose amendments to the committee. The way it reads at the moment might be confusing, and we have certain proposals to the committee. The thing is, to read
that Romans 4 in conjunction with subsection 7 of that provision. Subsection 7 is the one where we want to have the retrospectivity in terms of sentence defenders. The manner in which it would read at the moment would say, any person by, this is now Romans 4, any person convicted by a court and sentenced to a term of imprisonment, whether suspended or not, or any non-custodial sentence, that's any sentence, Chair, if a fingerprints were not taken upon arrest. And then Romans 5 follows and it says that the minister can, in the Gazette, list certain offenses in respect of which a fingerprint should be taken. So actually we're going, sub 5 would not make sense in the manner of sub 4 reads at the moment. So what we're proposing is that we actually only want to take fingerprints from everybody convicted and sentenced to term of imprisonment and to correctional supervision. And we want to make those retrospective applications so that police can go to everybody in prisons at the moment and we're in correctional service at the moment, and then it's not applicable to all of these, that it's possible to implement. So we prefer changing that wording, the stuff you would then read, Roman 4 would read, person convicted by a court and sentenced to a term of imprisonment, whether suspended or not, or correctional supervision, either non-intimate or fingerprints was not taken upon arrest. And sub 7 would then read, paragraph Romans 4 and of both A and B would apply to any person serving such sentence at the time of the commencement of this section, and where applicable, any person released on parole in respect of such sentence, irrespective of such sentence retrospective. So it would just make more sense and will be practically implementable. Also then Romans 5 would make sense that then the minister can, for other non-custodial sentences, decide which ones are really serious if we want to make a list instead of these must take print, then it's not open-ended. So those are some of the proposed amendments on this section. Then the South African Human Rights Commission. The power of police officials to take DNA samples should be limited to persons arrested for serious offences only. These offences or categories of offences should be specifically listed. Collecting DNA samples from persons arrested for minor offences seem highly inappropriate and a waste of state resources. Again, as shown in other jurisdictions, this DNA database is only really effective if you have a large profile reference index to run something you find in a crime scene against. And as has been the case in other countries, somebody is picked up for a minor offence such as drunk driving. Once you load the profile onto the database, you get a hit with a rape case or a murder case that's actually happened in the United Kingdom. And that person would have gotten away with murder if you could not have loaded his profile. That's why we arrested. That's why we're not restricting it to specific offences. Another problem, of course, with restricting it to specific offences is the police would charge somebody with murder, and they would take it. And then the prosecutor would come and say, oh, but on these facts, it's actually manslaughter. And then they should not have taken the print if we're going to say, it's going to be very difficult for the police officer to decide which offences are now falling within these categories based on the initial facts of the case. So you will just confuse the issue if we specify any specific offences. That was our intention. Yeah, that's good. Then, with the Human Rights Commission still, they said collecting DNA samples from every arrested person would cause the system to collapse, whilst only targeting certain arrested persons is said to diverse the same from other aspects in the system. This is again back to the issue of the specific categories listed in the bill. We reckon and restrict the taking of samples in that effect, and it's part of the implementation plan which the committee will still be dealing with this, the chair and proceed as to how this will be rolled out. Then, intimate samples should only be taken of accused and convicted persons where the persons were certain that the police official are of the same sex. Intimate samples will only be taken in that manner, as already specified in the legislation. So that's already addressed. The Law Society of South Africa, the LSSA objects to the taking of non-intimate samples by police officials for the reasons stated below. Firstly, they say the police officials are not trained as medical experts and may not be able to correctly take the said samples. The main reasons why preference is given for taking of non-intimate samples by police officials can be summarized as follows.
These samples are considered to be of a considerable degree less invasive than the taking of intimate samples that should intravenous blood samples, which are only taken by medical practitioners. The procedures are fairly simple for the taking of non-intimate samples, and the competency is not difficult to acquire. Furthermore, specially designed collection kits facilitate the taking of non-intimate samples, packaging, chain of custody, and prevention of contamination. Members, we've seen the example performed on Honorable Member Ochoa. It's really a simple training procedure, and the people already have such prime kits where they already take fingerprint samples for specific cases at the moment. Because it has a minimum impact on the availability of police officials and their duties, whereas the person needs to be taken to a medical practitioner, then it will place a huge strain on resources and take up much more time off such police officer. Only a small number of dedicated police officers will be permitted to take such non-intimate samples in the stations and will undergo training and be authorized to take such samples. Frankly, examiners and detectives will not be authorized to take such samples. That is where we split the responsibilities that's already set up in the crime scene policy of the police, where it's the one set of police officers to go to the crime scene, and it would be the police officer stationed in that station who would take the non-intimate sample. Then, the second submission made by the LSSA in that regard, they say the police have an interest in any criminal matter and cannot be said with certainty and confidence that such samples may not be exposed to contamination. Again, the prevention of contamination can be addressed as follows. The DNA profiles of all staff officials that attend the crime scene and handle exhibits will be loaded onto that elimination database. There will be a separation of responsibilities. The crime scene examiner and the detectives will not be authorized to take the non-intimate sample. Only the police officials at the station who are trained for, and thus authorized. The amount of non-intimate sample is limited and transferred directly to the lab and placed in evidence collection kits, which immediately seen to ensure chain of custody and non-tampering with such samples. National instructions and protocol will ensure that the correct procedures are followed. And then, of course, always the LSSA or other lawyers will be in court challenging this, and every time it would be for the examiner and the detective to go through the chain of custody. That is part of everyday court for lawyers. So, I mean, they would be able to challenge it, and the police will have to prove the chain of custody. And, of course, the office can be retaken in court and reanalyzed to prove linked with the... So there are a lot of safeguards in that sense built in. And it would be for the court then to decide whether such evidence is admissible or not. The court has the final say in that regard. Then the LSSA also say the integrity of such samples may not be relied upon. The samples will be taken by trained and authorized police officials who will be using specially designed evidence collection kits, and the protocol will ensure that the sample is sealed and to enforce the chain of custody. The unique barcode of the kit and the non-intimate sample, the date and time and by whom the sample was taken will be recorded. Furthermore, the details of from whom the sample was taken will be recorded together with their signature. All this will be placed into this evidence collection kit and sealed. Therefore, once again, it's something that any lawyer can argue in court, but then the police will have to prove the whole chain of custody, and it will be for the court to decide. And then, that say such samples need to be taken, the procedure must be done by health workers. I think I've addressed that issue by explaining the training and everything that will be accompanying this procedure. The fifth submission on this section is, in terms of the proposed amendment, non-intimate samples involve blood fingerprints, and this procedure is far above the competency of the official. Again, the competency required to take a fingerprint with the device in the evidence collection kit for the test is a simple procedure and can be easily acquired. Only dedicated police officials who have been trained and authorized will perform the procedure. It's a prick, it's put it on the seal it, and the training is not rocket science in that regard. Then, the second point, which is not related to the above, but the LSSA made, is they object to the taking of body prints by police officials, as this is likely to infringe on a person's right to privacy, and the process will have more integrity taken by a health worker. It is
proposal is taking a body prints by all the other body print samples taken by a police official will be taken in the so the medical practitioners are not qualified actually to take fingerprints. Fingerprints are taken by police all along. Medical practitioners do not get training in that. Taking of fingerprints, notices, earprints, police all receive training in those, and it's not something that falls within the purview of medical training. So that's why other prints will be taken by medical practitioners, but I don't think that those procedures are invasive, and it's once again an issue that they can argue in court, and it will be to the court of the Crown Bar. Then the Cape Bar Council, their first point they make is a non-interest sample should only be taken if it may assist in the investigation of a crime. Throughout the Cape Bar Council submission, if the you get the sense that they do not understand the taking of samples, the compulsory taking is meant to populate the database. They think that if you take a sample now from somebody, it must be linked to a particular case. That is not the case. They say prosecutors will be inundated with all these non-incident samples that are not linked to cases. That will never go to a prosecutor. What will happen is you take the sample, you extract the profile, load it into the database for use later on if there's a hit with the crime scene. There's no procedures that kick in the meantime, and it doesn't need to be linked to that specific case. It's for use in the future. And so that's where the Cape Bar Council places their arguments in this thing. So in future, though, if there's a hit with a crime scene where a lawyer would become involved with a client, then, of course, there must be a direct link to the case. Otherwise, it never proceeds to court in the first place. So that's all I can say on that point in this regard. Then the second point they make is clause 36B1B, Roman 4, the taking of non-intimate samples from convicted offenders makes no sense once the investigation has been completed. It is suggested that section 36B should read as police official may, if it's taken a reasonable suspicion that such evidence would assist in solving an offense, cause a sample to be taken, or words to similar effect. Again, the whole point of this legislation is to populate the database. And convicted offenders who already keep their fingerprints, etc., and the taking of DNA samples from convicted offenders retrospectively have been found constitutional in other jurisdictions with similar constitutions as ours. This has nothing to do with the particular cases for the purposes of running a DNA database for crime intelligence for those specific legitimate government purposes. Then the third comment they make is commencing Chapter 3 with Clause 36A may cause confusion. It's inserted before Section 37 in the chapter. They make the point that the existing Section 36 appears in another chapter. I mean, but in drafting, if you insert something before an existing chapter, it's drafting practice. If you get the same number as 36A, 36B, so it's a draft, a matter of how you draft, and it will fall in that specific chapter under that heading. There can be no confusion in this regard. And then the fourth submission from the Cape Bar Council is it is not desirable for a police official to take non-intimate samples. Such samples should be taken by medical professionals. Persons taking non-intimate samples should be properly qualified and have no ties whatsoever with the police station or the investigating unit. Again, the police will be trained in doing this. There will be the protocol to ensure that there is no linkage to the specific crime scene. It would be a person who is not stationed in a police station who would be taking the sample. So it's basically the same concern as raised by the attitudes A. And finally, it would be for these lawyers as well to argue these points in court, and then the police would have to show the chain of custody, and it would be for the court to make the final determination. But the safeguards have been built in. Then their fifth comment of the Cape Bar Council is the taking of non-intimate samples should be limited to more serious offences such as those in Schedule 5 and 6. It's also a previous comment made where we've explained why we're not limiting it to serious offences but to all, to the number of offences we've included in the law. Then it's Mr. Carver, who is a member of the public, who made some submissions. Definitely a lawyer.
the first point you made is the definition of authorized person is not limited to policing specialists involved in crime investigation or police officials concerned with DNA analysis and are open to appeal. The definition should define certain categories of police officials and should safeguard such as security clearances or levels of authority. If you look at the definition of authorized person in the bill, we specifically made a distinction between authorized persons in terms of photograph prints and authorized persons in terms of DNA. The DNA are only the specialists within the police commander commanding the division criminal record forensic within the SAC or user or delegate, meaning that people dealing with the database are the forensic analysts. That's specifically why we stipulated that. And then with regard to the photographs, fingerprints, body prints, it would be a police official and he's in the performance of his or her official duties, which would be a detective searching a photograph against a book of photographs, for instance. So we feel that we've addressed that concern of Mr. Carver. Then the speculation, can I just maybe I think I need to have, can you repeat the justification for authorized person? Yes. Authorized person, which distinguished between two groups of police officials here, because he's concerned if he wants to know specifically who it would be. And what we've done is with regard to photos and fingerprints and body prints, we take any police official in the performance of his or her official duty. The detectives, and I've got Commissioner Muna here who can explain this maybe more. Already, this is what they use in terms of their investigation. So this refers to the detective. Detective would be performing this as part of either her official duty, accessing the databases to check for. They would have these folders of photos of wanted persons that they will show to a victim, for instance. So that would fall in that category. But then, if we're dealing with DNA, then we say in the Roman 2, we're saying no. And there is not any police official, it's only the people working within the forensic lab that can deal with the database. So that's the distinction. So there is not any police official, it's only the police officer commanding the specific division, or he's or a delegate, which would be the science forensic analyst working in that section. So we distinguish the database from other investigators, because these other investigative methods are already used on a day-to-day basis.
On this issue, when we say that a police official must then take a non-intimate sample, that person would also be an ordinary police officer, right? Okay, because I think that's part of the concern here, because it does read a bit funny, because in some clauses we've got any police official and then we've got authorized person. Authorized person could also include a police official. So I think what we need to perhaps do is just scan through and see if we can't make it easier reading in that sense. The other thing that perhaps we can also do is, as I said in the other clauses where we talk about taking the sample from a crime scene, for example, is to be a little more specific about who can do that. So I really think that generally when you read the thing, it becomes you have to read like twice to understand authorized person. And I think that's the kind of niggling concern, because, I mean, it's, what really worries me is that the Bar Council don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the lawyers, so you can imagine. So I'm just saying that perhaps there is some room for us to tweak some of the things, and I think that can be done technically as well. So we don't need to labor the point.
Well, I think there has to be an ordinance. If only the chairman and must assess why this was done.
Thank you. Then the second point made by Mr. Harris is that search provision provides access to records from institutions to the samples were given, not knowing and without consent that they would be used for the purposes of as contemplated in the bill. This feature of the bill would, among others, give access to the private medical records of children treated in state hospitals.
no clear definition is given to the application in the government sphere and is open for abuse where the records of organizations or institutions who receive government funding are accessed and interrogated. Firstly, the speculative search is specifically limited for specific government purposes, and giving access to the records of Home Affairs would be specifically for the investigation of crime, etc. There is no way that you can access private medical records under this provision. You will not be given access to private medical records under the speculative search because it's limited to a specific database, and you cannot search because that section that he's referring to only deals with fingerprints, and how you can search the fingerprints against the medical records. We do not give access to that in the legislation, and it's criminalized should you use these databases for any other purpose. Fingerprints stored by Home Affairs are already used for a number of legitimate government purposes, and it's in our view that we're limiting it now, or we're opening it up now, to only the detection, investigation, and prosecution of crime in this regard.
On the issue of the legitimate government purpose, at the moment the phrase throughout the bill reads as follows. It reads, detection of crime, investigation of an offense, or the conduct of a prosecution. Now, those things, if you read it just very cursorily, will indicate that there's possibly an overlap between the detection of crime and investigation of an offense. But nowhere do we specifically say for the purpose of identifying an alleged perpetrator. In other words, the whole point of DNA is really to look for an identity of somebody who might have perpetrated a crime. So I think that it turns to how you interpret some of these things. Some people will say, look, if you're going to detect a crime, surely what you really mean is that you want to identify who committed the crime. But actually, in some instances, it could be argued that when you use the phrase detect a crime, sometimes, for example, you come across a dead body in a hotel. You want to know whether the person was murdered or not murdered, or whether this was something that just happened naturally. That in and of itself is the detection of a crime, to see whether somebody was actually the victim of a crime. So my point being, we mustn't assume that the very point of this database, which is to identify potential perpetrators, captured in those phrases. And we should specifically refer to the phrase identifying the alleged perpetrator of a crime.
Chair, we agree with that suggestion. Since Honourable Member now referred to those legitimate government purposes, we also just wanted to point out that SAS has requested that elsewhere in the bill, later on when it comes to the SAS Act, we say that some of these legitimate government purposes are also the investigation of missing persons and unidentified human remains. But we do not repeat it throughout the bill, so we're just going to insert, if it's in order with the committee, those legitimate government purposes throughout the bill, so we do not limit it in certain instances, because those are really important aspects as well. So then we were at the third point made by Mr. Harder, which was the provisions of Section 36(b)(1), 5, and 6, which relates to the taking of prison samples, the use thereof, and their retention, and Section 15(b), the speculative search of prison photographs are unconstitutional. If a person was merely arrested, his samples may be taken and subjected to speculative search. There is a lack of limitations and safeguards in this bill, and the purposes for which prison samples may be used are too wide and unqualified. It does not provide time limits for the gravity of the offense. Firstly, Chair, we built in the specific safeguards be limited to these legitimate government purposes, as in one case that I've already read to the committee where the court has found that the taking of a DNA sample, for instance, involuntary, for the purposes of criminal investigation is a reasonable and necessary step to ensure that justice is done and is reasonable and necessary in balancing the interests of justice against those of individual dignity. So this issue has been addressed by our court, and we believe that this is built in that you can only use it for those purposes, and should you transgress, it's an offense that we've addressed Mr. Harris' concerns in this regard. And speculated search will only reveal a person's identity if it's linked to a specific crime scene, and then the normal investigation will kick in. So the police will only have a name, and then they will go and retake fingerprints if it's, say, on the fingerprint database that the name came up as a possible suspect who might have been on the crime scene. Police will retake that person's fingerprint, so that safeguard is also there, and then it will be for the person to explain what he or she was doing on the crime scene. So, and the normal court procedures will kick in. Then we come to public. Came to this committee and made to the public hearing. And here we've got section 36B1B. And they propose stipulating the specific type of anonymous sample to be taken. Blood fingerprints could be considered by some to be more invasive than a buccal swab. Again, we did stipulate specific types of non-intimate samples. We set the three types or a combination of these, and I think we've dealt with this argument already this morning that a blood finger prick with the specific crime kit that's been developed by the South African Police Service is not an invasive procedure, and it would be open for people to argue it in court before the court makes a final determination. But as far as, and in any case, an international president around the world, fingerprint is also used in this manner as a non-sample. Then, as to section 36B1C, they propose provide also for an obligation to take photographic images of any person arrested. Here, it would be too onerous to do. The problem with photographic images is how do you search against it? People can disguise themselves, but your fingerprint and your DNA profile is set. There's no way to alter those. A photograph can be altered, and in any case, the police have the option to take a photograph of any of these categories of persons under Section 37. So should they feel the need and they know they want to have a photograph of this person, they can, but it's too onerous at this stage to make it compulsory, and the usefulness of that in an investigation is questionable. And that would be our response. And the police, in any case, have the option of taking a photograph. Then their third submission, they said section 36B sub 3, they propose inserting a new subsection C, the fingerprints to also provide, I mean, this is where fingerprints may be retaken if the fingerprints did not provide, if the fingerprints were not clear, or this is the provision that provides police with the opportunity to retake such prints, and they insert the option of also where the fingerprints were lost, files were not successfully stored on the fingerprint database maintained by the South African Police Service. We have no objections to including such a ground with the committee.
I wanted to say that I particularly agreed with that, because there could be all manner of circumstances, particularly given that this is something new that police are going to have to get used to doing and so on. And initially you may have these kinds of things cropping up where you're going to have to retake. And I think it's unnecessarily too limiting in the way that we've got it currently. So I do think that they should take that on.
Then the fourth comment from Fabric, they say section 36B sub 6, they propose inserting a new subsection D, or in subsection D they want to insert the following: any person who tampers with, misleads, or in any way changes fingerprints, intimate or non-intimate samples to be submitted, or any police official who submits fingerprints, intimate or non-intimate samples falsely claiming it to have been taken from a specific person, while knowing it to have been taken from another person or source, is also guilty of an offense. The department's view on this specific offense is that it would in any case amount to defeating the aim of justice in the Criminal Procedure Act, which is criminalized, but we're open for the committee's comments.
I want to agree that it is it does fall within the general purview of the Department of Justice, but I think there'd be no harm in putting it there. I think particularly given the kind of concerns that we've seen from the Bar Council and other people who simply don't trust the police, I think this is going to perhaps be something that is going to be needed, and specifically attached to the 15-year action, which I think is correct. I think that should be the case, and people should know that if these kinds of things are done, that it is quite a satisfaction, and people in positions of trust need to, you know, we need as legislators to send a direct message to people in positions of trust.
Seeing the last comment by topic, they say in regards to Section 36B, in order to ensure compliance, suggested that a provision similar to the provision contained in the Domestic Violence Act be inserted to make the institution of disciplinary proceedings compulsory against any member of the staff who do not comply with any obligations set out in Section 36B. It is the department's humble submission that this would be going a bit too far. Disciplinary proceedings are in any case available against any member for such misconduct, and such a provision would just affect the morale of the police very negatively and could result in non-compliance rather than encouraging compliance with building up the fingerprints and DNA databases. And it's already covered disciplinary mechanisms in the SAP Act. In Chair, there's a following submission from the of gender equality. Section 36B1A, Roman 3, proposes that this provision should stipulate which categories of licenses and permits make it compulsory for prints to be taken. It would be more reasonable for less serious traffic offenses to count towards demerit, which counts towards endorsement or uncertainty cancellation of driver's licenses rather than criminalization of such offenses. Again, we're not criminalizing this offense beyond the offense. Beyond what is necessary, the fact is that you would like to populate the databases, and that's the way and manner in which you go about populating such databases is by also including prints and samples taken from minor offences. Then POP crew, their first comment on this clause is section 36B1 and 37(1), where it refers to a police official must cause such prints to be taken. They ask the question by who. Yesterday we also had this question, and it would be by another police official. This is an existing provision in the Criminal Procedure Act and can in no way be interpreted this specific provision as referring to outsourcing. Then the second comment by Paul Crew references in the bill to the National Commissioner. This is now throughout the bill. The National Commissioner or either a delegate, they ask the question, who is the delegate? Furthermore, references to the National Commissioner as opposed to the Divisional Commissioner are deliberate efforts to misinform Parliament so that it is approved hastily and without proper deliberations pertaining to such grey areas. Again, yesterday we dealt with this coordinator or a delegate, and we said that in terms of the SAP Act, the National Commissioner can only delegate to another commissioner or to another police official. You cannot delegate powers outside of the SAP Act. And references in the bill where we use National Commissioner as opposed to the Divisional Commissioner is where it's really in reference to the making of national instructions, which properly falls within the purview of the powers of the National Commissioner. And we do refer specifically to the Divisional Commissioner throughout the bill where it deals with the database and who must store the, we're actually trying to empower that division. And then if we can move into Clause 2. There are no comments or questions. Then Clause 2 is Section 36C of the bill. There again we have a comment from Mr. Carver, who says the provisions and powers conveyed in the proposed Section 36(1) are too wide, undefined, and should be limited to certain scheduled offences and referred to an offence. It would mean that the staff can take blood samples where a traffic offence was allegedly committed without a warrant. In reading that section, a police official would have to have reasonable grounds to that a person has committed an offence and have reasonable grounds to believe that those prison samples derived from such will be of value to that specific investigation. It is therefore hard to see how a DNA profile of fingerprints taken for, can be taken for a traffic offence
there will be no reasonable grounds that somebody could believe that fingerprints or DNA samples could be relevant to a traffic offense. The DNA sample is not a blood sample for drunk driving. It is our view that there are sufficient safeguards built into this particular section. And as we pointed out, this section comes from existing provisions in the law that we've added in here and built onto. And it's the reasonable grounds for limitation applies to both A and B must be read together. The Cape Bars Council, to submit that clause 36C1A and B makes the taking of such evidence dependent upon their reasonable connection with the offense in question and forms part of the pre-trial investigation, and that such suspects are entitled to legal counsel and that the CPA ought to make provision therefore. And they propose an amendment to section 73(1) of the CPA to include such a right. 73(1) is the section where you have access to legal counsel. In terms of the Constitution, you can get that access to legal counsel. You can opt at any stage for one to be present. So it's not necessary to make it compulsory to provide it. We'll just provide the Bar Council with a lot of extra money in their pocket if we say there might be someone. But the accused always has a right to ask for someone to be present. I think our court has only ruled that if it's a photo book identification and not identification parade, then you don't have a right for legal counsel to be present, or it can proceed without the presence. But otherwise, you can always ask for the presence of someone to be present. Then the last comment was made by Suffolk. They said section 36C1. They propose irrespective of whether such a person or person has been arrested after the word warrant. It's not in our opinion necessary to insert this wording of the warrant on the person there's no need for such additional wording. Then if we move on to clause 3, which deals with section 37, the existing provision in CPA that we're amending. The NPA, the first comment here is that section 37(1A) we should retain a reference to fingerprints and insert the word for. The department, when we drafted 36B, where we made it compulsory for these specific sections of people to be fingerprints to be taken, we took out the reference to fingerprints in 37 existing provisions before those people would have been covered. But it has since occurred to us that maybe as part of the investigation, at least may still want that power, so there's no harm done in using that option as part of an investigation if they want to take fingerprints. So we would agree with the NPA to reinsert the word fingerprints there. So that's not a compulsory provision. It would just give the police more leeway as part of their investigation. Then the business against crime. They recommend that section 37(3) should give medical practitioners the power to take an intimate sample of any child who is admitted to hospital for medical attention or treatment and who is suspected to have been a victim of crime without a request for it being made by a police official to the medical practitioner. They reason that many victims do not approach the police immediately in order to save evidence that is bodily fluid, which may affect the successful prosecution of a crime. Section 37 does not apply to victims. Victims in practice volunteer such evidence, so we cannot insert such a provision here. Then Suffolk, their first comment was section 37. They propose including, again, like the FDA, fingerprints in the subsection 1A. And then their second comment, section 37(1C, they suggest adding reference to, nor shall a police official make any examination of the body of the person concerned where that person is male, and official concern is not male. This is a existing provision where the police would like to see if there's a tattoo. Currently, the provision reads that if the accused is a woman, the police official must be a woman. Now, the NC say, well, if the accused is a man, the police official should be a man. It's never been challenged in all these years, but this has been on the books. I don't know if there's any men out there who object to being searched for a tattoo in a place that would not be intimate by a woman. But, so we have no
and we should say the existing provision is better than and Chair, there's a third comment by Suffrick. They said section 371D suggesting serves the word provided that if the photographic image is required to serve as evidentiary proof that the body of a person has any mark, characteristic, distinguishing feature or appearance, and the taking of such photographic image requires that the person's undress fully or partially, such as the photographic image shall, in the case of a male person, only be taken by a male, in the case of a female person, only by a female. Again, Chair, this is an existing provision has never been changed and needed such an interpretation in the past, and such wording will require further investigation into the whole setup of the Criminal Procedure Act in that manner. And I mean, the photographs usually taken by the police, it's never been challenged in this manner. We do not see a need for that. And then the fourth comment by Fabric, section 372A, suggests to provide any registered medical practitioner or registered nurse may. The draft provision seems to be too demanding, and under the present wording, a police official whose offices just happen to be situated next to the consulting duties of a specific surgeon might constantly choose to utilize such services. It might be a business concern. It seems that they reckon that the doctor next door to a police patient might be bothered the whole time if it's a must. The purpose of this amendment, however, was to ensure that if a medical practitioner is requested to take such steps, he or she may not refuse and must take such steps in order to secure evidence to assist the police officer in an investigation. And in most instances, this would be taking place within our government hospital with medical practitioners working there, and we would not be competing on the private practice as much. That would be our opinion. And then POP crew on this section, they say section 373B, the words ascertain the state of health of any accused in such proceedings, the impression is created that the state of health of an accused can be ascertained by DNA analysis. That is an existing provision in the Criminal Procedure Act, and it's used by the court if the accused say, I'm ill and we cannot proceed, and the court wants to determine should we grant this postponement, is this person really as ill for such long, then the court can ask, it's a general medical checkup, it's not a DNA, this does not deal with DNA, so it's a general medical checkup. Then on clause 5, coming from section 225 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Maybe I should deal with all five comments here or read them all and then deal with our response to this. They seem to overlap to a greater extent. The Human Rights Commission, they suggest that section 252 should be removed in its entirety. The fact that evidence shall not be inadmissible if police officials do not follow the provisions of the bill is highly objectionable. And usable, the unfortunate complexion of being soft on non-compliance is open to malicious interpretation. The Human Rights Commission, however, is in support of the stance that it is too rigid to suggest that non-compliance automatically equals inadmissibility. And in this regard, Section 355 of the Constitution should give guidance as to the admissibility or otherwise of evidence. So actually, they answer themselves by they want to remove it in its entirety, but then they say the court. It's for the court to weigh up, and that would be my response to it if I come to it. Just now, there's a lot of case law on section 252, which is the existing provision in the CPA, and all we're doing there is inserting references to the new clause. We're not changing the position in law. Then, suffering is suggested to include a provision to address resistance by any mentioned person to submit to the taking of prints or samples. Then, the CGE supports the fact that evidence will be admissible even when taken against the will of the accused. Actually, the CGE answer separate, so it's already provided for in the current legislation and provision stands. And then POP crew section 225 sub 2, does it imply that results from speculative search shall be admissible at criminal proceedings? This practice is not consistent with, I'm going to deal with POP crew separately because they raised a different issue, but the first three are all interrelated. The current reading of section 225.2 is that it provides for two aspects. The first is that the admissibility is when you read the section, it states that evidence shall not be inadmissible only by reason thereof that it was taken not in accordance with the provisions in the CPA. And this is a provision, even though the Constitution in 35.1d reads that, and I can read 35.1d to the committee, I think every person who is arrested for allegedly committing an offense has the right, evidence obtained in a manner that violates any rights of the Bill of Rights must be excluded if the admission of that evidence would render the trial unfair or otherwise be detrimental to the administration of justice. Section 252 is only amended, as I said, as far as inserting existing provisions in law. Our courts have dealt with this provision after the coming into the Constitution in a number of court cases, and our courts have decided to follow the Canadian approach. In as far as if evidence such as fingerprints or DNA was taken in a manner not in accordance with Section 37, the court reasons that is real evidence. Such evidence exists, never mind how it was taken. So it would have existed even if the procedures followed were correctly applied. So our courts have admitted such evidence on numerous occasions, and I think the case will to the committee. So this is the aspect that the court weighs on a case-by-case basis. And that's why it cannot be excluded as part of the existing procedures of the court to consider whether evidence is admissible in a specific case. And I can refer the committee to the specific case law, which would be it versus R and so forth, and was also quoted in the it versus M case in the ECA in 2002 and another ECA case of 2004. So in that sense, it's a existing provision. And then the concern about the involuntary taking, what happens if somebody refuses to submit, that's the last part of subsection 252, the existing position, that it also allows evidence to be taken against the wish or the will of the person concerned. And again, our courts have found this to be constitutional. So that should relay those fears. Then POP2 makes a different point. They come and they say, does it imply that the results from speculated shall be admissible as criminal proceedings. This practice is not consistent with the DNA analysis as a tool in the fight against crime internationally and exposes possible human rights violations. And speculative searches are either the foundation upon which the software used in DNA databases operates, and a normal investigation will follow upon a hit, and evidence will be laid in court and will be for the courts to call on the admissibility thereof. That's exactly why you have provision 9252. And so apart from that, I think that should address their fears. It's not made a part of the DNA analysis process, but as part of the search that follows once you've populated the database, and that will then be submitted to court. Then other constitutional issues raised by the Human Rights Commission, they say the bill may be a violation of Section 35.1c of the Constitution in respect of the mandatory taking of DNA samples. Section 35.1c reads everyone who is arrested for allegedly committing an offense has the right not to be compelled to make any confession or admission that could be used as evidence against that person. It may be argued that the involuntary taking, the giving of such samples constitutes a forced admission. The Commission then continues to quote jurisprudence from other jurisdictions where it was held that the taking of DNA samples does not constitute testimony. Yes, so the Commission then actually gives us the U.S. and I think they refer to the U.S. in particular, where this has been found to be in accordance with the Fifth Amendment in the United States. But actually in South Africa, we've got jurisprudence, and it's in that research document that I handed out to the committee in the beginning where I quoted on pages, it's on pages 10 to 12 of the research document where I discussed the Lubak case and the Guma case, which are the court precedents laid down where the court found that you can take involuntary samples and it does not impose on human sequency or privacy, and the court waited in terms of the limitations clause. So that is our, there's actually South African case law, not many other two case laws from that point. And the court has also held that it's not part of the right to remain silent, or you do not incriminate yourself by using fingerprints. It's sorry, there's six or four cases on that fact, so that's the fourth that I raised here. Then, as to certain diverse comments and recommendations that are not maybe linked to specific aspects in the bill, the BAC recommends including the morphic touch technique or comparing fingerprints as one of, I'll compare fingerprints as one of the expected mechanisms that may be used by police officials. I must say I've also received a request from the police themselves to include reference to morphic touch. Morphic touch is that little machine that they were store when we were in the laboratory brief, and that they used the roadblocks at the moment, and they would just like to put that into legislation as well. They actually had a staff amendment, but they've just not had the opportunity to do that. So if the committee is open to this, we would like to incorporate that. Then the second point that the business can make, they say they recommend that fingerprinting and fingerprints and photos should be taken of all foreigners entering the country. This is a criminal legislation, that is a civil issue that will not assist us in, and this is a matter that they should raise with our affairs with the police. Then the Human Rights Commission. The bill provides insufficient safeguards that a person's data shall only be used for purposes related to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offence, or the conduct of a prosecution. Clear guidelines need to be spelled out in the legislation in relation to the maintenance of the DNA database, especially in respect of access to the database, in order to protect personal privacy. Provisions relating to custodianship should be spelled out in more detail. As to the protection of personal privacy, all that is stored on the database in regard to the DNA profile is a sequence of numbers that is not, that doesn't mean anything to the untrained eye. The profile is linked to a person's name in much the same way as we store fingerprints on our affairs. And access to the database is limited through the definition of authorized person, where we said it's only that division that deals specifically with the database. Again, when we refer to authorized person, where in some places authorized person, in some places any police official, the distinction should just be between where you take the sample, but you can't do anything with it. All you do is you hand it over to that unit, and then it's that unit to do the analysis, and that's where it's authorized person, because you can't hand it to any other station except. It's only them who can do this, the speculative search as well. That's where the, if we go through the bill as suggested by the committee, we should be clear as to the distinction there. And then, in addition, any conduct which will go further than any of these specified legitimate government purposes will, of course, be criminalized. So, in everywhere in the bill, I mean, previously when fingerprints were taken, for instance, nowhere was it stipulated in the CDA that it must be handed over to the specific division to be stored in a specific database. We've actually now, for the first time, we've written this into legislation. Previously, this was the practice, but it was never written down in legislation. So we've actually, everywhere we say where you take it, you give it to the division. So we believe that we've addressed the Human Rights Commission's fears in that regard. And also the national instructions that must be developed must come back to Parliament. So then Parliament can also check again whether, because some of these things must be spelled out further in national instructions, but then Parliament can again think whether it's clear or all the things clearly spelled out. In the second point by the Human Rights Commission, the bill does not provide clear guidelines for how DNA should be collected, stored, and used. The statement is made in the light of their earlier comments that DNA information may be abused, leading to probable genetic discrimination and social stratification. Again, the bill specifically says how it can be collected in section 36B and 37, how it should be stored. It refers immediately to the specific chapters where it must go to specific division in SAP, and how it must be used is only that specific provision 15L in the SAP Act that says it's only these authorized people who can run the checks against the database, and then it can only be communicated to that specific list of persons. So we believe that's the threat. And then also there's probable genetic discrimination and social stratification. The DNA profile, as shown, will only be that limited number. We will only know the gender for race purposes, but in case they don't have the machinery or the reagents to do any other tests. Should they want to, they will have to write it in on what else if they buy any of those reagents to check for medical conditions, and it's criminalized should anybody ever do that. So we believe we've addressed those fears. And as pointed out by some of the other submissions that were made by experts in the field and who supported the legislation, like Dr. Hancock, there's no proof of abuse of such a database elsewhere. Then, if we come to the third point of the Human Rights Commission, the Human Rights Commission supports the establishment of structures similar to that currently operating in the British model. The national, like the National DNA Operations Group, is focused on tactical and operational delivery of DNA services, and the Ethics Group, which provides independent ethical advice on operation and practice of the database. Here I can add that there is also a similar body that's in legislation established in the United States that operates on a federal basis. And should the committee feel open to this, we can investigate this further and come with possible drafting options on comparing the different systems. Because I did do research on that, but they of course not incorporate that. We can do that. And then if we come to fabric,
we just skip over that point. I think it would be very useful for them to do precisely that, to come up with some wording for such an oversight body, because I think a lot of the fears that have been expressed aren't sort of tangible things where we can pinpoint specific things, but kind of potential areas for abuse in the future. And I do think that such a body would go a long way to restoring everybody's faith in, really. I think it's just good practice.
Thank you, Chair. Then, fabric, section 36B1, they recommend the finding police official in the Criminal Procedure Act in this section in accordance with the FACTS Act. This is, what they propose is that the general definition clause in the Criminal Procedure Act should be amended. The thing is that this legislation, the way, if you read the Interpretation Act, it would be read in terms, interpreted in terms of the later legislation, and that if we start with such a clean-up exercise, there's a lot of outdated provisions in the CCA, and there's never been problems with interpretation, so we say it's not necessary at this stage. Everybody knows how to read the legislation. And then the CGE, the Commission on Gender Equality, recommends that training material for officials as provided for Section 15Q should include information relating to dignity, maintenance of confidentiality, and allowing for legal representatives to access, challenge as well as apply for rectification of incorrect information held in any database in terms of the bill. Legal representatives cannot be granted access to the database, which will defeat the safeguards we are building into the bill. They can challenge any evidence represented in court in the normal course of criminal proceedings, and the quality assurance standards provided for in this bill will ensure that the data integrity and otherwise would have to be proven in any event in any case where such evidence is submitted in court. As to their proposal for training on dignity and maintenance of confidentiality, there we have no issues, just where it relates to legal representatives. Because we believe that the police already have training material on how to deal with accused persons in accordance with the prosecution on dignity of its material. But I mean, it's open to the committee, that's just a legal representative that should not be contacted. Then the second comment by the commission proposed including requirements for details of all relevant qualifications of the specific individual who collected samples which generated the profile. The qualifications, etc., of such individuals will form part of the Section 212 affidavit, which it does at the moment already, and its existing practice in court that is proving the chain of custody and chain of evidence that has to be proven in each and every case that you need to state your experience as an examiner, etc., in the certificate before the court will accept such evidence. So it's already in place. There's a first comment by the Commission, Section 15J2D, not allowing the withdrawal of consent is unreasonable. 15J2D refers to the voluntary index. Not in allowing the withdrawal of consent is unreasonable because there are many instances where such consent may be legitimately withdrawn, such as where a person gave consent under duress or where intoxicated, this section should allow for consent to be withdrawn. This section is drafted specifically for volunteers, and you give informed consent when you meet all that criteria in subsection 2 must be explained to you. You cannot give informed consent in law if you were drunk, as they propose you're intoxicated, or under duress. It would not qualify as informed consent, and it will immediately be removed from the database, would never be able to enter. So we believe that the safeguards, there's a specific meaning of informed consent in law, and that it's made by the criteria stipulated in subsection 2. Then the final number of comments relates to COP crew. Firstly, they say the bill doesn't clarify the body which will serve as custodians of the database. This reflects as if the database will be administered and maintained by SAPS or the National Commissioner, but actually refers to outsourcing. If we look at the section that specifically deals with the database, it's section 15F, and it reads that the database, whether in computerized or other form, shall be administered and maintained by the National Commissioner and shall be located within the Division Criminal Records and Forensic Science Services. So it specifically states that it's located within that division. So we believe we address the fears of COP crew in that regard. Then section 212.8a sub Roman 2, the bill is not clear as to who or what the body is that may be designated by the minister under this section. That is the section that deals with presenting affidavits in court. It's the existing provision in law, and there's already a list of such bodies that's been proclaimed, designated in the government gazette. I don't have that existing list with me. I don't know if any staff members can clarify, but it's an existing list, and it will have to go. There's never been problems with that in the past. It's not, there's an existing list, and it's in terms of the existing provision 212 that these designations are made. If a person who come to court to testify or who presents the analysis of substances in court, such maybe it's I'm not sure if you've got any examples in practice where this is. Yes, certain scientists who would have performed, but it's specific bodies designated under the existing provisions. We haven't mentioned anything in that regard. And then section 15F4. They say the reference to DNA profiles were already stored, maintained, and administered by the division CRC and FHS. So this paragraph clears that the DNA database currently maintained will be taken over by the outsourced contractor. 15F4 reads as follows. Now, 15F4 is the provision we put in to ensure that the DNA already collected by this division will be included in the database. So there's no reference in that section that the database, that domain, the control over the database will never be outsourced. The only outsourced provision this committee debated on earlier this morning will be on the loading of a mass number of profiles in the beginning. But the control and no control will ever be taken away from the police, that specific division in the police unit. And then section 15L, referenced by them, and 15M, in their submission they refer to 15M, but from a reading of their submission it should be 15L. They say amounts to outsourcing of investigative duties, outsourced reading into the word national commissioner or user or delegate. 15L is the speculated search, and there specifically control over that aspect can never be done by anybody else by that division, and then it can only be communicated to the specific persons listed in that section. So there's no way that you can ever get the criminal investigation aspect over to any of the risks into the legislation. Thank you, Chair. Those are the comments we've received.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Reverend. Any other comments? Thank you.
the best exercise for us for us to be able to go through all the submissions that we received in their current state or their current state. I think this is very helpful, at least once in terms of some of the clause that have been mentioned here. Thanks to the presentation. Tomorrow we will then take the act or the bill, and then we'll do clause by clause. That is deliberating on that. Because yesterday I said you must take all the clause, and then we just ask you questions and clarities. But I think that in order for us then to understand each other, what we need to do tomorrow then is to go clause by clause and then debate that clause. And then understand and agree, not to agree, and agree on other issues. So that we can just rectify those that we don't agree upon. And from there then we will decide then which route to take after we understand each other tomorrow. And yes, you may add it.
If you read 15L1, I mean, I think part of the concerns that are raised can be addressed by not saying the National Commission or using the delegate, but be more specific, I mean, the head of that unit or whatever the case may be. But I think the problem comes in or an authorized person who can conduct these, and especially in light of the previous discussions debate that we had on the LCC. Who is this authorized person? If you say the commissioner or his delegate, now that's a nine-function delegation. That I think we all understand, I think in all sub-legislation we think about that. But who is this or any authorized person? That becomes a problem, because we've been told that they will not use that article.
Chairperson, if I may clarify that authorized person is then, if you turn to page 11, authorized person for this chapter means the police officer commanding that division within the police or his or her delegate. So that's the definition of authorized person. So it can only be that division. So if the committee suggests taking out the national commissioner or his or her delegate, we can remove that and then only leave an authorized person. Because that would, or if you don't want the definition, because authorized person is defined as specifically only that position.
I think it's clear that authorized person is a problem. Authorized person is a problem. There is no way that we can delete out the national commissioner and say, if we say that it's the divisional commissioner responsible for this, we put it the divisional commissioner responsible for that. I think it's what the members are saying. But this thing of authorized person and then delegate his or hers, it's where we have a problem. I think it's how you want it to be done, really.
Yes, because if you read it, then what you're saying now, I mean, I understand it, I'm saying what the confusion is, but if you read it as it is now, and you read authorized person, then it's saying the national commissioner or delegate, which should be the divisional head, or the divisional head, because it's saying national commissioner, divisional head, divisional head. So, I mean, I don't understand.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is the purpose of us as Parliament to engage the Department in what they are trying their best in legislating some of these things in this country. I think we've come to the end of the meeting today. Tomorrow we get a very formal now. We meet again tomorrow. I'm sorry, you tell us the day, you don't say the day, you same time and go through the piece of legislation, clause by clause, as I have said, debate issues, understand each other, agree not to understand each other, or agree to understand each other, and then we take a decision. What is it that we need to do about this piece of legislation? But listening to the debate that we had here, and also to the statement that was made by Honorable Sissons, I think you want to do justice of this Parliament. Or saying that within a week we passed this thing. As a person who's been deciding on many legislations that we passed, in some instances we say that we want to see what other countries are doing when it comes to this. Because this is a good piece of legislation. But it would be so good for us as Parliament to have a delegation of members of Parliament to go maybe to a similar country that is doing the same thing and copy what is being done there. And then we come back and say, this thing, if we say that
say, outsourcing is the best. We outsourcing things, outsourcing is the best. But that's not what I mean. But sitting here, a department is saying to us, there is nothing that we want to outsource here. And then at the end, we say that, yes, this is outsourcing. I mean, we should have come here from the onset and say that in order for us to have a good legislation, in order for us to be able to implement this, because we know that the police don't have capacity to do this, we think the best thing to do is to outsource this, and then we take it from there. But instead of that, we start this, and then we debate issues, and then we call people in, and then we say that there is nothing to do with outsourcing. But at the end, it's clear that our aim is to outsource this thing. Then we must discuss it and agree on that or not. Or not agree on that. I think we break now for lunch and then we come back tomorrow and start again with this discussion. S35 NCOP. S35 NCOP. Tomorrow morning. Thanks very much.
I'll get to your first.
It is lunch.